You're listening to Standing Room Only on Kill Radio. Good evening, Los Angeles. You are listening to Standing Room Only here on Kill Radio. This is your host, John Daly. And our guest this evening is Dr. Mitchell Earlywine, author of the book
Understanding Marijuana.
That's right. If it's okay with you, should we get right into the questions?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, let me start out by asking you, what motivated you to write this book? How did you get into writing this book?
A lot of listeners might not know, but I'm a psychology professor at the University of Southern California. I teach a very large drugs and human behavior class. Every semester, no matter what I'm lecturing on, whether it's Benadryl or cocaine, all the questions are about cannabis, one after another, after another, after another. And I thought, I need to get all these answers together, put them in one spot, so I don't spend the entire semester talking about pot. So next thing I knew, I sat down and I had this book.
Fantastic. And how long did it take you to put this book together?
It was about a 15-month project. I first put together a proposal. I sent it off to a bunch of different publishers. Oxford was the most prestigious and the hippest, and we went with them. And it took, 4 hours here, 4 hours there, day after day, and finally I got it all together and made it readable enough that I thought it was ready to go.
Did you get a lot of offers for the book, or was it something hard to sell because of the contents, because it was about marijuana?
I had no luck at all getting an agent for the book. I mean, none, absolutely zero.
No one wanted to touch it.
People would say things like, well, people who are interested in marijuana don't want to read about it, and people who aren't interested in marijuana don't want to read about it, so this book's never going to sell. But in fact, we're already in our third printing, so I'm glad I proved them wrong.
Yeah, it's been selling very well.
Yeah, and there were four publishers who made me offers, and Oxford was fantastic, the hippest. So I was
okay.
Yeah.
Exactly, fantastic. And it's a very good book, actually.
Oh, thank you.
We both have copies of it sitting right here.
All right.
So.
It's 20% off at the Barnes & Noble website, by the way.
Really? Are you willing to sign people's books if they send them to you?
I'd be willing to sign anyone's book, whether they send it to me or come by USC or anything they want. I'm happy to sign.
Fantastic.
Office hours are posted.
Yeah, you know it.
How long have you been a professor at USC?
This is my 12th year.
Wow.
I came there in 91 after going to graduate school at Indiana and doing my undergraduate work in New York City at Columbia.
And did you go right away into substance abuse research?
You could say if you
would call it that.
You could say that, yeah. In fact, I was doing a little substance abuse research even in college.
I understand. And should we get right into the subject matter?
Yeah, let's talk about marijuana.
Okay. Well, what are some of the problems surrounding research with marijuana? Because I know you had a great deal to say about it in your book and in your lectures I've listened to recently.
I think the bottom line is that the National Institute of Drug Abuse, who's in charge of all the marijuana that anybody who's a researcher can use, won't let people have it for certain purposes. And most of the studies of smoked cannabis end up relying on people who shall we say, aren't randomly assigned to smoke it. So we get a lot of people who do a whole lot of things as well as smoke marijuana, and then people mistakenly attribute the marijuana to be the cause for some of those things.
Gateway theory.
Gateway theory is a fine example. Amotivational syndrome, another one. The links between marijuana and crime, which I think are more a product of the drug war than any subjective effect of pot. Obviously, anybody who's ever been high knows that you're certainly not going to be aggressive, even if you're provoked. You're just too high.
And it puts you really in touch with more aspects of the other, counterculture or criminal culture, which, an otherwise legal drug wouldn't have any contact with.
In fact, that's the biggest argument against some of the gateway theory data. In fact, it looks like the only reason there's a gateway at all is that people tend to buy pot and then go to a place where there's also cocaine or heroin or other things for sale, and so that's how they run into trouble. If there were a legal marijuana market that was separated from the hard drug market, it'd be amazing how people could get cannabis without any exposure to those hard drugs and wouldn't run into trouble.
Have they been able to do any substantial research based on the people who have used it for medicinal purposes?
The data on medical uses are very compelling. I've been extremely impressed with the work with AIDS-related wasting, with folks who have chemotherapy-related nausea. Both those groups seem to respond extremely well to cannabis as far as maintaining their weight or decreasing nausea. And it's funny because a lot of the anti-cannabis folks say, oh, they should take the THC pill. And the THC pill is not something you really want to swallow if you're suffering from nausea and vomiting. But they also, my friend Ethan Russo calls them the caviar of medicines. They're $13 a piece. And so you could have $39 worth of THC pills or $5 worth of cannabis a day.
Synthesized, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it doesn't necessarily have all the other cannabinoids that, you know, science hasn't proved, but could have health or have beneficial effects.
Well, and in fact, as you talk to folks who've taken the THC pills, they say it just gets you baked out of your mind, and it's because it doesn't have probably the cannabidiol to sort of take the edge off the hallucinogenic properties, if you will, of THC in its pure form.
Oh, wow. I'd always imagine them more as like harmonics in a music note.
Exactly. I think that's a good way of thinking of it.
Now I'm going to prove that I did my homework here for a moment. Didn't you mention in your book, though, what about glaucoma?
As it turns out, the glaucoma data aren't as great as they once were. So,
right.
Yes, cannabis does decrease the pressure inside your eye, but it only lasts for about 3 hours, so you have to smoke up pretty often. And there's actually a new Canisol eye drop that works even better, lasts for about 8 hours, and doesn't have any psychoactive effects at all. So I hate to say it, but the glaucoma folks need to turn to Canisol and not cannabis.
What is Canisol based off of? Is it completely synthetic?
It's related to the cannabinoids, though, and the research was done in Jamaica, where you know a lot of folks of Jamaican descent do have a high risk for glaucoma, so that's how they got to do that research.
Well, let's. Can we talk a little bit about gateway theory? Because I think that's a big one.
Sure.
And that's what's it is, and it's interested me a lot because, you know, for years we've been hearing over and over again, whether you believed or not, you heard in the media, you heard the governments expounding all sorts of research and testimony that marijuana leads to drug use of more severe drugs.
When I was in junior high, I remember the health teacher telling me, if you smoke pot, a few months later, you could be shooting heroin. And it was
right.
just like this real cause and effect sort of thing. In fact, when you take a look at heroin users, many of them say, oh, yeah, I did use marijuana first. They also breathed air, did homework, you know, did all these other things first. Yeah. And unfortunately, we don't hear about the 76 million other people who smoked marijuana and never went anywhere near crack cocaine, heroin, or any other drugs. I think what really seems to have happened is anything that's most common happens before things that are less common. So people often ride bikes before they ride motorcycles. It doesn't mean riding a bike causes riding a motorcycle.
But I heard it causes drug use. So.
Exactly. So there you have it.
That's been proven.
If anything is a gateway, it's probably those nasty cigarettes. I hate to say it.
Why would you say that?
In fact, when you look at kids who go on to use hard drugs, the thing that they often did first is actually smoke cigarettes. Or some other data suggests they really banged a lot of coffee. So they were like sensation seekers as little kids and would, you know,
I knew coffee was behind it. I always knew coffee was behind it.
So if anything, that's the gateway drug.
You think the fact that marijuana is being currently targeted as a gateway drug explains a lot of the recent, you know, wave of commercials specifically targeting marijuana over obviously much more dangerous drugs.
If I were the drug czar, John Walters, I have to admit I might be tempted to do the same thing. He's got the president basically breathing down his neck saying, lower drug use, lower drug use. Well, let's see. There are 80 million Americans who use marijuana, so I could focus on them, or 6 million who've tried crack. Could I focus on them? Obviously, if I got to bring the numbers down, I got to focus on the thing that's most popular. So cannabis it is. Now, the idea that it's going to make you pregnant, for example, as I've seen in one commercial, or, you know, make you shoot your friend with a gun, which seems to me a better argument for gun control than anything else.
Yeah, you don't want to get up to even load the gun.
Yeah.
So,
and of course, we're now, you know, all drug users are currently funding the terrorists as well, so.
Well, and I appreciate the domestic cannabis that must be funding the terrorists. I know Humboldt County is really connected to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. Well, Al-Qaeda.
There you go.
Hey.
There you go.
Well, and there's certainly a lot of politics wrapped up in this. Let me read a quote for you here, and this appeared in the Fort Worth Weekly.
Da-da-da.
Yes. Reefer Sadness. The name of the article. It was in December, is what they have to say about it. The fight isn't easy. Government propaganda, the recent conservative victories at the poll, a growing gap between federal and state laws, bitterly disputed research, which, of course, has to do a lot with your book.
Happy to dispute.
And the powerful lobbying force of alcohol and pharmaceutical companies have dropped the simple green plants into a complex shroud of smoke. Bad pun aside, how would you respond to that idea that pharmaceutical companies and alcohol are strongly lobbying against marijuana use?
Well, alcohol, for one, here is a recreational drug that is guaranteed to damage your liver, damage your brain, damage your heart, damage just about every system but hearing. And it's legal and making money hand over fist and bringing in the tax dollars. Now, if cannabis were suddenly legal, gee, who's going to sit down to a fifth of Jack when they could have three joints instead? I don't know. But the bottom line would be, here's another drug, marijuana, that doesn't hurt your liver, doesn't seem to hurt your brain at anywhere near the rate that alcohol does, doesn't have negative cardiovascular effects that have been proven, has some mild pulmonary problems, some lung problems like bronchitis from daily users for 6 years or more. We're talking a pretty minimally harmful drug here relative to alcohol. No one's ever died from a toxic dose. I can't say that with alcohol. So obviously they don't want this out there. Now, my best pal from college is now a worker for Anheuser-Busch, and he says, you know, look, we got a lot of beer to sell, and if people are smoking pot, they're going to drink less.
Anheuser-Busch, by the way, who recently purchased SeaWorld and have turned that park into the Anheuser-Busch SeaWorld. And it's great because, and I'm just going to take a little side note here, because I was down there at SeaWorld the other day, and not only are the Anheuser-Busch Clydesdales prancing down the main street of SeaWorld inside the park. Yeah, well, they are aquatic because they swim in beer. But there is an Anheuser-Busch pavilion now in the center of the park where you can go, and I don't know if you realize this, you can go and get free beer.
Free beer for the animals.
Yes, the human animals. And I found out, and I found this out myself, that there's really no limit on the free beer. I mean, they tell you to, but if you just keep going up there, they don't argue with you because they have 80 beers from around the world to sample.
Pretty soon someone's going to try and French kiss Shamu, and they're going to have to cut that, you know, policy.
Yeah, then they'll start, I don't know, making you sign a waiver before you get your free beer or something. But the really disturbing thing about the whole thing was when I noticed next to the free beer pavilion was the Anheuser-Busch gift shop. And there are all these families in there who have gone to enjoy a day at SeaWorld, and they have all these little kids, and they're all running around. And all these little boys and girls are running up to their parents with these Anheuser-Busch, you know, Budweiser propaganda souvenirs. And they're like, Dad, can you buy me this can opener? Can you buy me this Budweiser chair? I really, really want it. And I'm sitting there drinking my free beer, thinking, wow, this is really, really disturbing. I almost don't want to drink this. But then I went up and got another one.
That doesn't make any sense.
Oh, get that brand loyalty going early on.
Exactly.
Cigarette lobby is the other one.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, here's a drug that, you know, generates more statistics than any other drug, for one thing, but kills a whole lot of people every day. It's costing us tons and tons of cash. And obviously, at least one study shows people who smoke pot tend to smoke cigarettes less. And
really?
Despite the evidence that marijuana smoke has more carcinogens in it, people don't smoke as much marijuana as you smoke cigarettes.
Isn't it also usually filtered in a better way?
Well, in fact, the new vaporizers that have come out, which they heat the cannabis and you can draw this vapor through this sort of hot air through the cannabis to get the THC and other cannabinoids without a lot of the tars and carcinogens and stuff like that, is doing a really great job. And we don't have enough data to tell for sure, but it looks like it's going to be a great way to reduce pulmonary harm.
Can anybody buy one of those vaporizers, or do you need a prescription?
Tobacco vaporizers.
Out, there are a number of websites that market vaporizers for botanicals. And so if you want to vaporize kava, for example, it has a very soothing effect, and it just so happens other botanicals may work as well.
Was the main idea behind those, though, medical use?
I think that's pretty much the idea, but it's a good harm reduction for anybody who's a regular user of cannabis, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're going to smoke it, you might as well reduce
your
harm.
I've heard that for cigarette users, if you smoke a cannabis in addition to it, it can actually help as an expectorant. In some studies, it's actually longer, prolonged some people's lives.
As it turns out, it's different in different studies. So one study, if you smoke both cannabis and cigarettes, it's actually worse than either alone.
Okay.
Clearly, the primary problem is the nicotine. Nicotine paralyzes the cilia in your lungs that are usually designed to help you throw things out, and once those are paralyzed, that's not going to work.
So you mean the effects are additive?
It gets in there deeper.
They're multiplicative, even.
Multiplicative.
It's worse.
So it's worse than one or the other together.
It's worse than the sum of the two.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Well, we need to take a short break. We're going to listen to the music news with Mike TV, and we'll be right back with Mitch Earlywine. And you are listening to Standing Room Only on Kill Radio. In a month on the show, we're going to have Meredith Jules and Josh Fadum. They currently have their work on display at the Basement Gallery in Echo Park. I want to give them a little ad here because they have some amazing stuff, some good photography, and Josh Fadum does an artwork like no other. It is Etch-a-Sketch art. And you would not believe this art. It's amazing. Wow. It's intricate. It's explicit. Did I mention it's intricate?
Just don't shake it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Please, please, if you have the chance, go by the Basement in Echo Park, the Basement Gallery, 1650 Echo Park Avenue. The show's going to be on until April 13th. They're currently showing Saturday and Sundays from noon to 5 p.m. You are listening to Standing Room Only. Our guest this evening, Dr. Mitch Earlywine, author of the book Understanding Marijuana. So we were just talking over the break about...
Oh, all sorts of stuff, the history of it and how it kind of first became illegal. Would you like to...
I'd be happy to jump in on that. At least here in the States, what happened was alcohol prohibition was repealed. So the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics at the time, Harry Anslinger, said, "Oh my God, I'm going to be out of a job." And he and his cronies said, "We better find another drug quick. Hey, I hear there are these nasty Mexicans down south who are smoking this weird loco weed." And
is that what they actually called it?
Yeah. And so then they went down and it was... Maraguingo is the Spanish term for tobacco, and they said, "Oh, let's call it that because cannabis, everybody knows that's just the hemp plant. Let's not say that. Let's make up this new exotic-sounding name." Depending on who you read, perhaps the Hearst newspapers helped spread the word with some of these strange stories like Victor Licata, who smoked a joint and took an axe to his family. Oh, by the way, he also was hearing voices, but we didn't mention that part in the news.
Not and then, for veterans.
Yeah, Anslinger went to the Congress and said, "Okay, we need to pass this Marijuana Tax Act." And in 1937, it didn't make cannabis illegal so much as just made it absurdly, ridiculously expensive to distribute it.
Now, was this before or after tobacco was taxed?
Oh, so tobacco was already taxed with a vengeance by then.
Okay.
So, yeah.
This was already old hat.
This was actually based on a taxation of rifle ownership that... suddenly it seemed like the way to control things was not necessarily to make them illegal so much as just tax them so that way rich people could keep them and poor people could not. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much how that worked. And if you look back at some of the old, like Louis May Alcott has stories about eating hashish and stuff like that, and it's all these old rich people bored out of their minds with nothing to do but eat hash bonbons. And so then by 1937, the federal laws were there, and each of the states had pretty much administered a law as well. A lot of folks, when you read like the transcripts of the congressional meetings, they're like, "What is this marijuana?" And they go, "Oh, I don't know. It's a narcotic of some kind." The birdseed industry came and said, "Are you talking about cannabis?" And they said, "Yeah, we are." And they said, "Well, we need those seeds. That's what helps birds." And they said, "Well, can't you use, you know, sunflower or something?" And they said, no, these are the best." So they said, "Okay, you can keep them, but you have to heat them up to the point where they couldn't make a plant grow anymore." So
sterilized.
They basically agreed to have sterilized seeds. It was, you know, a sad day for... folks who had been using cannabis in tinctures for, say, nausea, vomiting, and things like that at the time, mm-hmm. and the subset of, say, jazz musicians and other folks who were sort of counterculture started getting arrested left and right. So our beloved Louis Armstrong did 9 days in jail right here in L.A. for possession. It's kind of a weird thing. And then gradually, the Boggs Act of 1950, other laws started kicking in, making penalties worse and worse. The pendulum swung the other way. When Carter was president, it really looked like federal decriminalization was a possibility. He said, "Gee, the laws shouldn't have more negative consequences than the drug itself."
Yeah, yeah.
But unfortunately, basically somebody in his administration got caught with some Quaaludes, and it made him have to get hard on drugs and look like he was a tough guy or things weren't going to go so well. And that's pretty much how it progressed. And then National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Law, the Marijuana Policy Project, other groups have been getting together trying to keep this under control, but with 700,000 marijuana-related arrests last year, it's still clearly spinning out.
How about the Reagan administration and the new war on drugs? Did that have a huge effect on marijuana as well?
As it turns out, the number of marijuana-related federal arrests stayed about the same because they pretty much were only looking for folks who had, say, 90 pounds or more, somebody who was clearly dealing. Yeah. But I think what happened was a lot of folks just sort of took on that whole just say no Reagan ethos and learned things about pot that weren't really true. Basically, the idea that cannabis caused aggression, for example, was pretty rampant then. The idea that cannabis led to hard drugs, which we've already talked about, that gateway theory was more popular then. The data just don't support it. And, you know, obviously cannabis doesn't cause aggression, things like that. The data on cannabis and driving were misunderstood then, too. And as much as I don't recommend driving high, if you look at those data, folks in the Netherlands have had people get high and then get in the car with, like, you know, the driving instructor guy. And it shows that what they do is they tend to increase the distance between their car and the car in front of them. They tend to slow down their speed. They're less likely to try to pass. They also increase their stopping distance. Well, so what I recommend is don't drive high, but drive as if you were. My gosh. Increase the distance between you and the car in front of you. Go ahead and take your time stopping. Take your time driving. Don't try to pass other people. In contrast, alcohol, the one drug that makes you drive like a total idiot, well, gee, that one's legal. There we go.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what are the physiological effects of the drug. Let's get into that.
I think the things to separate are the acute and the chronic effects. So okay. Just acute while you're high effects, there are some, you know, meaningful impairments in what they say cognition.
Uh-huh.
In all honesty, you do not learn new material well when you're high. So you're not going to, like, go to a lecture high and say, oh, I'm going to remember this. It just doesn't happen.
That's the short-term memory.
The short-term memory. However, once you come down, if you compare, you know, users to non-users on, you know, large tests of memory, often they do report statistically significant decrements in folks who use every day for 2 years or more. But then when you look at the data, it's like they half a word difference. Basically, they don't really forget that much, especially when they're not intoxicated.
Not.
Now, we do see chronically, if folks smoke every day for 2 years or more, these changes in their brainwave patterns. And essentially what it is that chronic users have problems separating relevant from irrelevant stimuli. And my dad just thinks that is so hilarious because basically, you know, people who are high all the time think everything is related to everything else.
Uh-huh.
And that's, in fact, what their brainwaves are suggesting that they think as well. However, we do show some recovery with just 30 days of abstinence, so people tend to get all that functioning back to normal relatively rapidly.
Can you see that effect in a small amount of use, or is it only for long-term use?
The only data that have shown so far are daily users for 2 years or more. So it takes, you know, it takes a pretty consistent being stoned all the time in order to get that to happen. Other physiological effects, you know, the effects on hunger and satiety, obviously, the acute intoxication and hunger seems to be dose-dependent. So, for example, folks in the Bahamas and Jamaica and places like that say they smoke pot in order to stave off hunger, but it's usually a much higher dose than folks are using here in the States. Mm-hmm. And at low doses, that appetite enhancement is pretty clear. Richard Fulton at Columbia had folks who, you know, lived in this little sort of dorm and smoked pot every day as part of this experiment. The days they smoked pot, they tended to increase their calorie intake as much as 40%, which is great if you're trying to maintain weight. It's not particularly great if you're trying to keep weight off.
So where are the supermarkets and all this? Why aren't they jumping on the pot bandwagon?
You know, I mean, I saw a shirt the other day. It said, cannabis brought to you by the snack food industry or something like that. And
pizza delivery business has don't ask, don't tell policy. You know, it's...
Oh, well, when I lived in Indiana, the pizza guys were the guys who sold the dope. So it was good for business.
No, where I live, it's the ice cream man. So I guess it's. What about the social problems involved? I know that you dedicated an entire chapter of your book to the social problems.
I think the big ideas for social problems were that amotivational syndrome, which clearly doesn't exist. Everybody seems to know one person who is clinically depressed, happens to smoke pot, and doesn't do very much all day. And they think the pot causes that. And when you look at the data on things like grades in high school, grades in college, how much money people make, how much taxes they pay, how many days they take off, anything like that, it just doesn't stand up. Now, college students, huge samples, like 1,400 or more, they compare the pot smokers to non-smokers. Their grades are the same. Their extracurricular activities are the same. The pot smokers are actually more likely to plan to go to graduate school, which tells you something about grad school, I think. High school students, yeah, there are pot users in high school who have lower grades than their non-using high school peers, But then you look back at their grades when they were in fourth grade, when I really doubt they were smoking any pot, and their grades were lower than two.
So maybe there's social influences and other things going on, and somehow pot just got involved in the whole mix.
Tell the truth, I think it's that, you know, people who smoke pot, it's not that people who smoke pot don't want to do anything. It's that people who don't want to do anything like to smoke pot.
There's a lot of the cart leading a horse arguments when it comes to marijuana. I can think of several.
Gateway theory fits that. Amotivational fits that as well.
Yeah. So then where did this amotivational theory come from? Because it must have been born out of some research.
There were two psychiatrists who had about 13 adolescents in their inpatient unit who all smoked pot and all were clinically depressed and didn't want to do anything. And they just reported that as this sort of finding. And then suddenly people jumped on this as, oh, this is something cannabis does. Now, I'll admit, the acute effects of marijuana are not exactly like cocaine, where you suddenly want to get out and go do stuff. But
clean your room 200 times, right?
Yeah. Or, you know, methamphetamine, where you're going to spend 3 hours scrubbing the tub.
Right.
And so I think it, particularly in a culture where we worship productivity as if it's like our deity, then, yeah, this seems to be a non-consumerism kind of drug. Gee, you're going to smoke this and then just watch a DVD and eat cupcakes and be happy? Well, we don't want that. We want you, you know, smoking crack where you're going to go wild and buy things. So that's, I'm afraid, what happened with that.
And produce. Nothing worthwhile, but you will be producing.
Produce, consume, produce, consume.
The other social problems, the driving, as I mentioned, doesn't seem to be impaired at all. In fact, two studies have shown folks with cannabis and only cannabis in their blood are a little less likely to be involved in accidents than folks who are completely straight.
Because they're so slowed down and cautious. And
I think so. I think they really compensate.
Now, but what if you're really, really baked? I mean, what if you're just, like, out of your mind?
Then you shouldn't be driving. And to tell the truth, I can't recommend driving high. It's just nuts. Especially in L.A., where it's really a buzzkill, I think, to...
Yeah,
be high
everybody
and then
else
drive.
Is on cocaine. And
exactly.
Speed, so.
Yeah. And then the crime question, which,
yeah.
I mean, you get folks in the lab, you have them smoke a joint, and then you can irritate them, and you can do all kinds of nasty things to them, and they still don't get any more violent than the folks who get the placebo pot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is the folks who get the placebo pot are a little disappointed. But...
highly agitated individuals.
Yeah, but I have a grant from the National Institute of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse right now doing that same thing with alcohol, and people get really ticked.
And when they get the O-duels, yeah.
Yeah. but also, once you're drunk and somebody irritates you in the least, people really do get hostile. Hmm. So,
but you're paying them, though. I mean, they're getting something.
Yeah, at least they're getting some money for that. Other social problems, amotivation, crime... that kind of stuff. I mean, really, you know, what else does cannabis do?
Well, like even the amount that I think people that don't smoke pot, their attitudes toward people that do have, you know, become much more lax in recent years. It's become much more socially accepted. And so I think, I don't know, some people who may have stayed in to avoid that before probably don't need to fear that as much anymore. And so because it's more out in the open and more common, I think that causes less stress and maybe than it would have... 10 years ago,
I think
user.
Also people are coming out of the closet, so to speak. So suddenly, the fact that 80 million Americans have tried this drug is dawning on people. Hey, one in three people I meet has probably tried marijuana. Holy cow! And maybe some of them are actually productive members of society, paying taxes and writing books on cannabis and teaching in universities and having radio shows and, you know, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not this stereotyped Skid Row. Horrible person anymore.
No.
Criminal element.
The minority, really.
Exactly. I mean, I don't like to draw too many parallels, but I feel like as the gay community, people became more and more open about sexual orientation, and suddenly we realized, hey, all these people I like happen to be gay. Well, now it's sort of the same thing. Hey, all these people I like happen to smoke pot.
And we now know that leads to crime.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean, homosexuality used to be criminalized, and that's,
yeah,
I mean, people might not think it's a good analogy, but I think it's perfect.
Unfortunately, in some places, there are still some laws still on the books.
Anti-sodomy, et cetera.
For one.
Yeah.
Puerto Rico, even.
Boy, that was a showstopper. okay, well, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back after this.
Good evening and a happy war to all. It's me once again, LYT. Let's talk movies, since you're probably sick of talking war. Actually, let's talk war movies, since there are a couple of them out there right now. the timing seemed to work around 9/11. People loved the war movies then. I'm not so sure they're going to now, because we're actually committing troops this time, and 9/11 was just a once-off. But anyway, let's give it a shot. There are sort of two competing war movies out there right now, Tears of the Sun and The Hunted. Both radically different takes, and my politics will slightly bias me, I suggest. But I'm guessing that anyone listening to Kill Radio probably is somewhat sympathetic to my side of the fence, maybe even more extreme than I am. Tears of the Sun is, well, Bruce Willis has sort of suggested that this movie is his sort of exhibit A as to why we should go to war against Saddam. It's about, you know, fighting for freedom and fighting against tyrants and so forth. And at the very end, there's a quote that the only thing that it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. I forget who said that, but one of you smart guys out there can probably tell me. The Hunted, on the other hand, is kind of an anti-war movie. It has Benicio del Toro as a finely trained killing machine who fought in Kosovo. And then he comes back and he can't really adapt. He becomes this sort of militant environmentalist, believe it or not, where he kills hunters because the hunters don't fight fairly and don't kill the animals with their bare hands the way they're supposed to. It's a real sort of macho thing. And then Tommy Lee Jones has to come out of retirement and catch him one-on-one, mano a mano. It's by William Friedkin, you know, who directed The Exorcist and The French Connection and a bunch of shitty movies after that. This one's a little better. It's a lot of nonverbal stuff, a really good extended chase sequence in there that I really like. Now, a lot of people I saw the movie with found it preposterous. There's a part where Del Toro apparently really quickly rigs up a big death trap, like the one Schwarzenegger had in Predator, with giant logs with spikes on them that come swinging down. Just roll with it, people. It's an action movie. I rolled with it. I really liked it. It's got the whole, it's the whole sort of, you know, man on man, you know, bare hands, making your own knives, slaying your protege, or trying to. You know, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. They quote that at the beginning. Making things a bit more biblical and giving it more resonance than it deserves. But Johnny Cash songs on there. That's pretty cool. Tears of the Sun, on the other hand, maybe it's just my politics, but this is a movie that wants to be really profound as a war movie. It wants to be more than just a war movie. And ultimately, I think it's a failure because it's not deep enough to be a really good art house movie or to really make you think a lot. And it's not action-packed enough to be a good war movie. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua, who did, Training Day. That one. Won an Oscar or something last year. Anyway, Fuqua apparently thinks he won the Oscar, not Denzel, because now he's getting all important on us. And, you know what, it really doesn't do it. I mean, they should have just focused on the action a bit more. You know, focusing on the atrocities, okay, but then just, a lot of it's just walking through the jungle, and there's a lot of action at the end, but it leaves sort of a bad taste in your mouth when you think this is our justification for Iraq. Plus all the African bad guys speak English. I don't know what that's about. And, you know, the people who complain about Black Hawk Down being racist don't have a problem with all the black people getting blown up by fighter jets in this one either. But maybe it's because there's a few token good black guys. There's one token black guy in Bruce Willis's little patrol. Maybe that's what keeps it from being racist. I don't know. So if you want my war movie pick, I'd say see The Hunted. But you probably don't want to see a war movie. Go see Spirited Away. It's still playing at the Arclight. 7 o'clock, I think, is the showing. If you want just pure escapism to be taken away into the fantasy world, and Spirited Away, of course, the best movie of last year, in my not-so-humble opinion. You got to love the movie studio's timing, because next week, the big studio releases are, one, about soldiers killing each other over drugs, that'd be Basic, with John Travolta. One, about the end of the world, that'd be The Core. And another about an idiot running for president. That'd be Head of State. Talk about escapism. I don't think any of these movies are going to do well, but you make up your mind. And next week, I will be on the show to promote my brand new DVD release, The Tattoo Connection. So until then, check out my website, lytrules.com, if you want to yell at me about my stupid politics or tell me why I'm not radical enough and I should not be supporting war movies no matter what. Until then. Yeah.
And we are back with Standing Room Only on Kill Radio, killradio.org. My guest, Mitch Earlywine, author of Understanding Marijuana. It's that time in the show where we are accepting phone calls. If you have any questions, give us a call. The phone number here is 213-252-0998. If you can't get through, please keep trying.
And no, we don't know where to find any, so thanks.
So give us a call. And we're back talking about
marijuana. I should mention that I do have folks who write to me from the web and things like that, and I get some pretty diverse responses. So right now, an organization in Oregon has put my NPR interview up on their site to talk about how NPR has turned into this big harm reduction place and how they don't want their federal money going for harm reduction propaganda and stuff like that. And then, you know, at the end it says things like, Earlywine must be smoking his own pot and not paying attention to the literature. And they say things like, well, there are 15,000 studies to show that cannabis is bad, and there are only 8,000 studies of marijuana, like, total in the entire world. So I don't know where some of this stuff comes from. So,
well, even McCaffrey's study that he did at the end of his term, you know, proved everything they didn't want it to, so they just dismissed it. And the government has a terrible history of commissioning a study. You know, when they don't find the result that they want, they just, you know.
Nixon had done that years before and did the same thing.
Yeah.
It's amazing how misinformation can just spread like wildfire through anything, particularly with a topic as hot as this. People just, they hear one thing and then it becomes something else and then it becomes something else. And then pretty soon, yeah, there's 15,000 studies that show that marijuana is going to turn you into a lazy psychopathic killer, which we all know is true.
Even the notion that you'll just become an apathetic slug is hard to dispute. And people,
however, some people are apathetic slugs.
Well, and people always remember the one apathetic slug they knew who smoked pot and forget the other people who may have used it and were productive.
The stereotypes are funnier.
Of course, maybe he was just an apathetic slug to begin with, and one day, you know, a bag happened by him. He just never got up to do anything else.
I mean, that's it, exactly. The other thing that I see a lot is, for some reason, folks seem to think that cannabis was suddenly invented in 1960 or something like that. And I do want to point out it goes all the way back to 2737 BC when the Chinese Emperor Shenang prescribed marijuana for nausea, vomiting, rheumatism, arthritis, and a whole lot of other things, that some of which it probably wasn't so helpful for. But if you think about what medications were available at the time, it really seemed to be quite the wonder drug for the era. But people didn't smoke it back then. It was you know, eaten as hashish or cannabis and made into tea, which actually doesn't seem to work because the cannabinoids aren't really water-soluble, so I don't know what that did for people. And then, you know, ancient Romans, ancient Greeks, a lot of folks used it, and all the way through Queen Victoria, who seemed to use a cannabis extract for insomnia and menstrual cramps. So. Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that really bugs me, is that it's been used for thousands and thousands of years, yet the fact that it's been illegal for the past 70 or so, it's been effectively wiped from the memory of mankind, and they don't remember how long it's been around.
As John was alluding to earlier, the drug industry is not going to make any cash off a plant you can grow in your own backyard.
Right.
So already we're at a complete disadvantage. So Lester Grinspoon has a few individual cases of marijuana used as an antidepressant successfully, and oh man, they went crazy over that, because, you know, right now antidepressants are like the third and fourth most popular drugs around.
And they're expensive.
Exactly.
And they have to keep creating new ones because people get
you habituate
used
to one.
Yeah, exactly. They get used to one, and they only last, what, 2 or 3 years sometimes?
2 years on an antidepressant is just a complete sin, as far as I'm concerned, given that cognitive behavioral therapy, usually 3 months of good treatment will lift a depression without any chemicals at all.
And without permanent side effects like a lot of these chemicals do. I mean, that's the antidepressants that are on the market right now permanently change someone's brain chemistry. You can't introduce something into a biosystem and have it have no side effects. Whereas marijuana, you can regulate your dose if you're depressed, and, you know, you can use it. If you're not, you don't have to, and that choice is important for medicinal purposes.
I'm going to play the devil's advocate here, though. Isn't self-administering any drug getting into a dangerous area, even marijuana?
I think at least with depression, I would rather see somebody go to a psychologist for cognitive behavioral therapy. Just the data are really, really good that suggests that it's just as good as antidepressants and better than some of the old tricyclic antidepressants.
Yeah.
But self-administered drugs, I don't know, it's kind of an authoritarian, patriarchal thing. Like, why do I need to have an MD say, oh, you can take it, but I can't take it myself? I don't know. given that marijuana is psychoactive, that's where we get particularly scary. Oh, this is a drug that doesn't just make you capable of happiness, it actually makes you happy. Uh-oh, very dangerous. Ah! And there is a subset of folks, depending on what study you look at, between 9 and probably 12% of regular users who start to develop symptoms of dependence. They show a lot of tolerance. They show mild irritation and withdrawal when they don't have the drug. They're kind of preoccupied with it. When the baggie gets a little low, you see them starting to get a little wild. And I have to admit, Roger Rothman's data up at University of Washington suggests that, you know, this is for real. This is not a completely harmless drug. This is not like water.
Is there any research that's shown the typical amounts that someone would have to consume before it actually became that problematic?
The individual differences in quantity are so hard to estimate, because how much is in a bowl, how much is a joint, things like that. So instead they focus primarily on frequency, and it's usually the folks who are smoking every day who run into the problems with both tolerance and withdrawal.
Is that more a problem of habit then? than the actual drug?
Yeah, I think if people would be more mindful of their use instead of automatic about it, like if you constantly, you know, oh, it's 5:30, time to light up, then you're not even enjoying it. It just doesn't seem to work the same way. Whereas folks who are willing to do it on occasion, really appreciate it, pay attention to the effects, and enjoy it and cultivate it, are much less likely to run into trouble.
Like anything in life, you know, you appreciate it more when you don't do it as often. And I've heard a lot of working for a lot of different drugs, is that the things you may have take the drug for initially, actually there's kind of a reverse effect, you know. And in the sober state.
So you do kind of have this opponent process, if you will, that you have this opposite effect later on. And again, that's a product of large doses. So I think people who binge on cannabis often are the ones who the next day seem to report a lot of problems. And folks who do it so consistently that it's no longer something they even notice. It becomes transparent, then you're really not enjoying it.
Transparent to them, probably not to the people around them.
Exactly.
And you say... I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, but they become, what, victims of their own habit. They're constantly...
And then it's really not fun anymore. It's just something to do. And I think if they would be more attentive, they'd be surprised that they actually do enjoy the drug more, even though they're using it less often.
I would like to talk about prohibition.
Sure.
I read that you were quoted as saying that prohibition may cost more money than it actually saves, prohibition on marijuana. What is the story with that?
Well, if we think about, particularly in states where the penalties for cannabis are such that police end up busting somebody for, say, an ounce, they have to take them down to the station, they have to get them fingerprinted, they have to get them booked, they have to waste basically half the day on this one marijuana bust, and then the prosecuting attorney says, what, you gave me an ounce of pot? This isn't worth my time. Let this guy go. And it's completely wasted. When we've got people out there, you know, raping, murdering, pillaging, you know, terrorists, all these things to worry about, obviously those are all these unsuspecting costs. But if you break down just, we had 700,000 arrests, what's the you know, the federal budget, what's the state budget for all these kinds of things, it ends up being in the $20,000 per arrest range.
That's for a lot of money.
For a pot bust? For a pot bust? We don't spend that much on a year of educating a public school kid.
Not to mention, you know? And all the money that goes towards the misinformation programs.
Yeah, I could buy a car with that.
Millions and millions.
Well, and this is just for federal and state law enforcement, never mind the money that the drug czar is throwing in order to have a commercial that makes you think smoking pot makes you pregnant. You know? So, yeah, I really do feel like that's money that would be markedly better spent elsewhere. Suppose we suddenly funneled all that into treatment of drug problems. Lo and behold, if we have a separate market with cannabis disconnected from crack cocaine, heroin, all those nasty things, and the subset of folks who do develop problems with cannabis know they can go to a treatment program where, incidentally, if you go into an inpatient program right now and say you're a pot addict, people will laugh in your face. And obviously, we need to have a different setup. It needs to be different, and I think the money we'd save would be well spent on cannabis treatment.
Actually, that was my question. I was going to ask, I noticed in your book you talk a little bit about some of the most recent treatment methods. Can you talk a little bit about what's available for anyone out there who is interested in cutting down or quitting?
It's a very good question.
Both the cognitive behavioral treatments and this new treatment called motivational interviewing are really, really productive. And in part, it's because it relies entirely on what an individual is willing to do based on his or her own goals. Hmm. You sit down with a therapist, you list the pros and cons of using, the pros and cons of not using, and then it's all up to you. And it's interesting because I think getting to list the pros and cons of using is really important. People need time to sort of relish how much fun this is and say goodbye to it and talk about why they really, really love it, as well as talk about how things might be better if they didn't use it, the money they might save, the time they might spend other ways, and just the possibility of enjoying it if they want to use it less often, or if they really do want to go without it, you know, one day at a time in a sort of approach like that, how they would go about that. How do you refuse pot that's been offered? And you rehearse that with the therapist. How do you decide not to go by the old places where you used to purchase cannabis and things like that? And it's a matter of, ideographically, each individual has to have his or her own approach, but the data have been extremely, extremely impressive. The other opportunity is social support. So if you want to join a 12-step group, there's a Marijuana Anonymous. There are folks in Narcotics Anonymous who would be very sensitive to having you join and being willing to help out, so you can hang out with people who don't use drugs and still have friends, still go to dances, still go to parties and all that kind of stuff. And it seems to work out really well. Now, lots of folks, I have to admit, quit on their own. They just say, you know, I've had enough of this. They put it away. They say, I'm going to take 30 days off, and then they never go back.
Or they have kids.
Yeah, or they have kids. And boy, having a 2-year-old, you don't get to have a lot of pot around, I'll tell you that. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned going to dances and going to parties and stuff. Exactly how big a part of smoking pot do you think is the social aspect of it? Is sitting around with your friends and...
When you ask people about their use, it's almost always in a group. Very few folks get high on their own.
As opposed to
themselves.
Alcoholism.
Yes, whereas the stereotype of, you know, opening a fifth by yourself is very much the case. And I think what happens is that social facilitation, if you're ever around folks who are smoking pot and you're not, you find that you're having plenty of fun and they're even funnier than when you're high. So there's something to be said for being the person who's not smoking. And in fact, as more and more people do that, you also find out, hey, there are different facets of this relationship and I like these people straight, or in fact, I don't and I want to go hang out with other people. So there it goes.
Do you have any other questions?
Oh, man, coming up on the top of the hour, I have too many questions to fit into one night. I should probably buy the book. In fact, I think I will. My curiosity has definitely been piqued. I hope the same can be said for LA and anyone else who's listening to us on the web.
Was there any closing comments you'd like to make?
I would like to recommend to people that if they want to get behind the marijuana movement, the Marijuana Policy Project at mpp.org is really working hard to try to change marijuana laws, and they could really use your help. They would love to send you emails. They would love to get you involved. Just go ahead and check out the website and see if they're doing the kinds of things you'd like to get involved in.
Is that the one Ethan Nadelman works with?
Ethan Nadelman's at the Drug Policy Alliance, which is also a very good crew, but these guys are focused exclusively on marijuana. Again, it's mpp.org. And thanks so much for having me, John. I really had a great time.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been Standing Room Only with our guest, Mitch Earlywine, author of Understanding Marijuana. And, of course, our associate producer here in studio, Matt Shibesta.
Associate producer? Yeah, I get a title now.
I just gave you a raise. You asked some good questions.
So. Do I still have to bring coffee?
Yeah, you still have to bring the coffee and donuts. And is my car ready yet? Because
Can I get up now? Being a footrest is a little uncomfortable.
This has been Standing Room Only with your host, John Daly. And we'll see everybody next week. The news is up next. Goodbye, everybody.
Toodles.